from deep inside your radio.
Always another button to push, ladies and gentlemen, but you are the button that I like to push. Now, as journalism continues its fearful downward slide in this country, just a touchstone, just a landmark on that trip, I think it was about 20 years ago that I submitted as a kind of a jocular idea to a certain magazine a piece about newspaper editors polling their readers to find out what stories they should cover. It just seemed absurd. Now, from the Donald W. Reynolds Journalism Institute, don't tell me you haven't heard of it. Editors responded to a survey. Why are they wasting their time? Don't even ask that. There was an important survey from an important institute. 90% of the editors said yes to the question, does your newsroom receive web, that is to say, internet analytics reports about data such as page views, length of visit, and traffic on your website? 41% say they look at it, those statistics, daily. 49% of editors report that their newsrooms make decisions about what stories to cover based at least partially on the web analytics reports they receive. That is to say, they decide what to cover based on what stories get most page views and length of visits. Analysis shows that weekday circulation size was a significant factor in editors' responses, as newspapers with a circulation of 25,000 or more, that is to say big papers, make decisions about news coverage at least partially based on those web analytics reports significantly more often than small papers, who just say, let's clip the AP wire as usual. Open-ended responses to the question revealed quite a range of practices, from constant access to analytics to a statement that analytics reviewing lies with the publisher, not the newsroom. Well, he's on his way out. If he's not out already, that guy said that. Babe, it's a new era. Now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the godly. The Irish priest blamed in an official report for his failure to report cases of alleged clerical abuse to the authorities has defended his actions, but also said he should have resigned from his position. Monsignor Dennis O'Callaghan, the former vicar general of the Diocese of, say it with me now, Cloyne, says he still doesn't agree with the Irish Catholic Church's 1996 guidelines, which made the reporting of abuse cases mandatory, reporting to the police. He says he should have resigned in protest against those regulations. Quote, for most of those priests accused in Cloyne, the complaints alleged incidents dating back 30 or 40 years. Of those priests, some would now be terminally ill, while others would be under constant medical care, says Monsignor O'Callaghan. You see. The last month, a judicial inquiry blamed Monsignor O'Callaghan for failing to report 9 cases of alleged abuse made between 1996 and 2005, which it said should very clearly have been reported to the authorities. The Monsignor was assigned responsibility for child safety by Bishop John McGee, who resigned his office last year. The Monsignor in question has finally retired this year. He says he argued against those guidelines when they were being drafted on the grounds that the form of mandatory reporting, this is mandatory reporting of alleged cases of child abuse by priests, compromises the, quote, Christian duty of pastoral care. The literal guidelines did not allow for any discretion to bishops and to their delegates. Reporting was to be made immediately. No exception was to be made even when an accused priest was on his deathbed. Unquote, the former Monsignor of Cloyne. The Army Corps of Engineers, personnel in charge of managing the Missouri River's dam system, exchanged internal emails this past spring, in April, that described the upcoming flood season as a huge water year and possibly one of the wettest years on record. But according to North Dakota water officials, those serious concerns were not publicly conveyed until a month later, after heavy rains fell in the Montana, Dakota, Wyoming, and the Corps says it was going to then be forced to substantially increase Missouri River dam releases, which then resulted in severe flooding. Officials say by then it was too late for residents in those affected areas to buy flood insurance, because it takes 30 days for it to take effect. If property owners knew what the Corps knew in late April, more might have bought coverage that would have provided some compensation for their ruined properties, according to North Dakota's governor. Jody Farhat, chief of the Corps' Missouri River Basin Water Management Office, said the Corps is not responsible for cluing people to buy flood insurance. All right, then. Well said, Officer Farhat. We'll keep that in mind. Hello, welcome to the show.
Took one look at you, and it was plain to see you were my destiny.
With arms open wide, I threw away my pride. I'll sacrifice for you, dedicate my life to you. I'll go where you lead.
Come on, baby.
Always there in time of need.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer. Yes, right back in the historic Legacy Le Show Dome, I'm Harry Shearer welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. Yeah, Irene, huh? It's been interesting. I've waited in vain for the usual commenters to say, what the heck are 55 million people doing living in harm's way? Down by the water and where a... No, they didn't. I wonder why. But now... Tales of Airport Security. Kind of a theme, Tales, this week. Don't tell Bob Dylan. First, Patricia writes, Dear Harry, 2 weeks ago I was on a domestic flight in India from Jaipur to Mumbai with a transfer in New Delhi. My flight from Jaipur to Delhi would continue on, landing first in Chandigarh and then in Srinagar, the capital of Kashmir. That's worse than my itineraries lately. But Patricia continues. Because of the high level of sensitivity, passengers were required to remove the batteries from our cell phones and laptops. My iPad doesn't have a removable battery, but the security officer seemed to know this and told me just to take the battery out of my cell phone. I placed the two together in my backpack, passed through another security checkpoint, and boarded my plane. Once on board, I watched my fellow passengers reassemble their phones, putting the batteries back in them, one with the help of a flight attendant. When I arrived in New Delhi, I had to pass through security again before entering the terminal. Sounds like Atlanta. I was stopped because I had a lighter in my bag. I was scolded, asked how I got through security with this banned item, and forced to give up my lighter. After entering the terminal, I walked into the smoking room, where I was immediately offered a light with multiple lighters. And Ernie writes, "Dear Harry, before boarding a flight from Hong Kong to Guam..." Wow. What a cosmopolitan audience I have. "Boarding a flight from Hong Kong to Guam," Ernie writes, "I had to surrender one of two cigarette lighters I was carrying. You can have one, but not two lighters, sir," I was told. En route from Hong Kong, I bought 2 liters of Bombay Sapphire Gin on sale, half price from duty-free sales that the flight attendant offered. I now had 2 liters of gin and a lighter. Next, with a stopover in Saipan, we were told we had to deplane the aircraft and bring everything with us. Upon reboarding in Saipan, with no transit route for reboarders, I was told I could not bring the gin they just sold me back on the plane. But yes, I could bring the lighters back on, and presumably I could buy another 2 liters of gin containing 40% very flammable alcohol. Making you feel safer than you want to feel. Tales of Airport Security. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Speaking of which, explaining something on last week's broadcast, several, maybe half a dozen listeners had written in and said, "Hey, Harry, Dick Cavett, you think stole your thing?" And I went and looked at their link, and it linked to a piece that Dick Cavett had written in the New York Times, apparently just online, with at one point in time the headline "Tales of Airport Security." The headline was since changed, or was later changed. But in any case, that's what the jocular references were last week. A lot of people were asking me about that. And I think it's my obligation. Now, news about the News Corp thing, because, you know, they might not be covering that so much these days. And I'm going to point you to my sense of self-restraint in sharing the following story with you, and you'll see what I mean right away. Australian media figure Ita Buttrose says Rupert Murdoch suggested she have someone followed while chasing a story in her time as editor-in-chief of the Australian Telegraph newspaper. She said the media mogul asked her to, quote, "go beyond what I thought I should do," unquote. She was working on a story at the time at Ms. Murdoch's request. "I assigned a reporter to do it, but Murdoch wasn't happy with the result and said, no, that wasn't good enough. Have you followed this person?" She then approached her immediate superior and told him, "I can't give this instruction. I'm not having anybody that works for me for whom I'm responsible follow anybody. I don't want to be a part of it." A News Corp spokesperson in Sydney says Ms. Buttrose's allegations are false. Quote, "Mr. Murdoch has never asked any journalist to do anything improper. No one has been, particularly the executive in Australia, has never been asked by Mr. Murdoch to have a reporter conduct surveillance of any kind on any individual, nor would he have agreed to it had he been asked by Mr. Murdoch or anyone else." Ms. Buttrose declined to reveal the subject of the story in question. Ultimately, it was dropped. It didn't go on. It didn't go into print. She was the first woman to edit a major metropolitan newspaper in Australia. She stayed at News Corp for 4 years, although, quote, Rupert once said to me, he's got everything he wants out of an editor in 18 months, unquote. And the News Corp phone hacking scandal has prompted the state of New York to kill a controversial $27 million contract with one of the subsidiary companies of the Octopus. State Controller Thomas DiNapoli this week quietly rejected the Education Department's contract with Wireless Generation, a News Corporation thing. Wireless Generation was to get $27 million of the state's $700 million in Race to the Top funds to develop software to track student test scores. That's right. It's not enough to have them take tests. The test scores now have to be tracked. And you have to hire somebody to do that, don't you? See? Really? News Corp's being reviewed by U.S. Attorney General Ho-hum, ho-effing hum, but the controversy proved too much for the state to stomach. In light of the significant ongoing investigations and continuing revelations with respect to News Corp, we are returning the contract with Wireless Generation unapproved, says the state controller's office. That office also cited an incomplete record about News Corporation's qualifications as a cause for concern. And here is real news. A spokeswoman for News Corp declined to comment. Normally, they make the most pugnacious comments. Imagine, that's the whole point of their PR operation. But no, not now. Interesting? Or just existent. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Billions of tons of carbon trapped in high-altitude permafrost. I said permafrost. Permafrost may be released into the atmosphere by the end of this century as Earth's climate changes. This would further accelerate global warming, according to a new computer modeling study. I can't get any girls to do that for me, computer modeling. The study also found that soil in high-latitude regions could shift from being a sink to a source of carbon dioxide. It would emit it rather than absorb it by the end of the 21st century as the soil warms in response to climate change. This research by the University of California's Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, Dr. Charles Coven, conducted the research with a team of scientists, and the stuff was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. I sent him a letter. I thought the print was too small. I haven't published it. Their findings counter results from a comparison of models included in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's 2007 report. That comparison found that climate change will spark a growth in high-latitude vegetation, which will pull in more carbon from the atmosphere than thawing permafrost will release. But unlike those earlier models, the new model includes detailed processes on how carbon accumulates in high-latitude soil over millennia and how it's released as permafrost thaws. Because it includes these processes, the model begins with much more carbon in the soil than previous models. It also better represents the carbon's vulnerability to decomposition as the soil warms. If global warming continues as expected, it's estimated almost a third of all flora and fauna as species worldwide could become extinct. Scientists from the Biodiversity and Climate Research Center, somewhere, doesn't say where in the world that is, but, and the Senckenberg Gesellschaft for Naturkunde, which suggests this is Germany, discovered that the proportion of actual biodiversity loss should quite clearly be revised upwards. By 2080, more than 80% of genetic diversity within species may disappear in certain groups of organisms. This is the title article in the journal Nature Climate Change, the first to quantify the loss of biological diversity on the basis of genetic diversity within species. These genetic variations are a central part of global biodiversity, you see. You do see, don't you? In the first study of its kind, researchers have linked a natural global climate cycle to periodic increases in warfare. See, it's not our fault. It's not our crappy leaders. The arrival of El Nino, which every 3 to 7 years boosts temperatures and cuts rainfall, doubles the risk of civil wars across 90 affected tropical countries and may help account for a fifth of worldwide conflicts during the past half century, according to the authors. An interdisciplinary team at Columbia University's Earth Institute. This is in Nature magazine. In recent years, historians and climatologists have built evidence that past societies suffered and fell due to connection with heat or droughts that damaged agriculture and shook governments. This, though, is the first study to make the case for such destabilization in our present era, you know, us moderns, using statistics to link global weather observations and well-documented outbreaks of violence. The study does not blame specific wars on El Nino. Why not? I blame El Nino. Let's wipe El Nino out, can we? Just send $4 to wipe. No, sorry. Nor does it directly address the issue of long-term climate change. It does raise potent questions. And really, that's all you can do. Given the paucity of answers, all you can do is raise potent questions, don't you think? Ocean waters, you know, expand as they warm, like mercury in a thermometer. Surely you've observed that. Surely you've watched your This, along with melting glaciers and ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica, drive sea levels higher over the long term. That is to say, the warming of the ocean expands the waters. For the last 18 years, two spacecraft have been monitoring the gradual rise of the world's oceans in response to global warming. While the rise of the global, this is according to Science Daily, while the rise of the global ocean has been remarkably steady for most of this time, every once in a while, sea level rise hits a speed bump. This year, more like a pothole. Between last summer and this one, global sea level activity actually fell by about a quarter of an inch, says climate scientist Josh Willis of NASA's JPL in Pasadena. Blame it on the cycle of El Nino and La Nina. I'm telling you, let's wipe out El Nino. Just send $4. Willis said that while 2010 began with a sizable El Nino, by last year's end it was replaced by one of the strongest La Ninas in recent memory. This sudden shift in the Pacific changed rainfall patterns all across the globe, bringing massive floods to places like Australia, or actually Australia, and the Amazon Basin, and drought to the southern United States. This extra rain piled onto the continents in the early parts of 2011. Where does all that extra water in Brazil and Australia come from? The ocean. Huge amounts of water evaporate from the ocean each year, while most of it falls right back into the ocean as rain. Some of it falls over land. This year, the continents got an extra dose of rain, so much so that global sea levels actually fell over much of the last year. So if, ladies and gentlemen, you and I drink all that water, no, it'll still go into the ocean eventually. I don't know. See what I mean? Potent questions, really, all we got. Because the answers are News of the Warm, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. If we drink all that water and refuse to pee it out, then the oceans will... I'm going to work on this. I'm going to do some computer modeling.
From our headquarters in Washington, this is Face the Meat with Bob Schlifter. Now, from Washington, Bob Schlifter.
And good morning again. While the East Coast, and therefore the media, and therefore the nation, has its eyes on Hurricane Irene, we're going to be talking this morning about the other big story this week, and of course that's Libya. After rebel troops entered the capital of Tripoli a few days ago, it looked like this story was over. But subsequent events, including messages from Colonel Gaddafi and frequent appearances in Tripoli by his son, Saif, have given indications that we can't take our eyes off Libya just yet. So we're talking this morning with two senators who have strong feelings on the subject. In Nogales, Arizona, Senator John McCain.
Good morning, Bob.
And here in our Washington studio, Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut.
I'm glad to be here, Bob.
Well, we've got some bottled water and batteries.
Well, it's a good place to be, then.
It sure is. Senator McCain, you've been very critical of the Obama administration for its handling of the Libyan matter. Here's what you said a couple of weeks ago on Fox.
My only regret is that this administration moved so slowly and reluctantly to commit American military power to this mission.
Well, now that Libya looks like a NATO success story, do you still feel that way?
Yes, I do, Bob, and I'll tell you why. This was a bad person. He was a danger to his neighborhood. He still has some WMDs, and we don't know what he might do with them if he feels cornered. And I just think leading from behind, as our president admitted he was doing, just leaves you in the long run looking at the backsides of Britain and France.
Oh, if I can add something to that, Bob, is that by laying back as the administration has done, we've sent a signal to the people in the street that they are in control. And now we don't know who they are or what they stand for. We've got a good friend and staunch ally in that neighborhood, and you know the Arab street isn't necessarily on their side.
Yeah, well, so, and also, Bob...
Senator McCain, sorry to have to interrupt you, but I'm just getting word that our correspondent in Libya is reporting that there's been a new audio tape released by Colonel Gaddafi saying that his troops are launching an all-out assault on what he calls the rats, in his words, of infested Tripoli. And the AP is reporting the rebels are falling back in many areas of the city. Now, you were saying...
Well, Bob, Senator Lieberman and I visited with Colonel Gaddafi a couple of years ago in Libya after he courageously decided to end his nuclear program. We both felt that he was someone we could work with, and I think we're now seeing signs that he's a strong and resourceful leader.
And Bob, this administration has spent nearly $1 billion trying to pick winners in a country where we had a government that both Senator McCain and I felt we could do business with. I just hope that if this trend continues, that Colonel Gaddafi understands that there have always been people in the American government who want to work with him, not demonize him or isolate him, and to bring him and his very important oil resource fully into the community of nations.
Well, but doesn't this put us at odds with our NATO ally, Senator McCain?
Well, Bob, you know me. I'm kind of a straight talker.
Yes, indeed.
I just hope the day never comes when an American administration decides policy based on what makes other nations happy as opposed to what's right.
And, Bob, let me just add, as we're nearing the anniversary of 9/11, we need reliable partners in this very challenging part of the world. Colonel Gaddafi has indicated over and over again his desire to...
And now we have our correspondent, Alan Dozier, on the line from Tripoli, gentlemen. So let's just go to him for the latest on the situation. Alan?
Bob, what we're seeing from our vantage point near the newly renamed Martyr Square is a rout. Rebel troops have regrouped, and in one of the most disciplined operations they've pulled off since this battle began, they've sent the forces loyal to the Gaddafi regime, which at this point seem to be primarily mercenary troops from nations in southern Africa, sent them retreating all the way back to the outskirts of the city. Most of this area is quiet now. The gunfire for the moment has ceased. Bob?
And back here to Senator Lieberman. You were saying, Senator?
Well, Bob, I just want to say, and I'm sure Senator McCain joins me in this, that this is a great day for liberty. Nobody knows better than Senator McCain and I do the suffering the Libyan people have undergone at the hands of this man. And I just wish this administration could get off the sidelines and get to the head of this parade, which is where we belong.
And Senator McCain, any last word from you?
Well, Bob, I just want to associate myself with the words of my good friend, Senator Lieberman. For the life of me, I can't understand our hesitancy to aid and lead the forces of freedom in Libya. I'm glad the president has cut short his vacation. I just hope he cuts short this policy of waffling with the liberty of the Libyan people, Bob.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us this morning. Our usual panel has fled the city to find safety in the foothills, so until next week, so long.
This program was produced, and the selection of the guests was the sole responsibility. Face the Meat came to you from Washington.
Smokey Joe's Cafe. Oh, why? Smokey Joe's Cafe.
One day while I was eating beans
at Smokey Joe's Cafe,
just sitting digging over the scene
at Smokey Joe's Cafe,
a chick came walking through the door that I had never seen before. At least I never saw her die
at Smokey Joe's Cafe.
Ooh, and I started shaking when she sat right down next to me. Ooh, her knees were almost touching mine
at Smokey Joe's Cafe.
Her chill was running down my spine
at Smokey Joe's Cafe.
Oh, I could smell a sweet perfume. She smiled at me, my heart went boom. Then everybody in the room
at Smokey Joe's Cafe,
they said, man, be careful, that chick belongs to Smokey Joe. From behind the counter I saw a man, a shelf hat on his head and a knife in his hand. He grabbed me by my collar and began to shout,
up all your beans and bar and clear out on that.
Yes, I know I'll never eat again
at Smokey Joe's Cafe,
and so we'll never meet again
at Smokey Joe's Cafe.
I'd rather eat my chili beans at Jim's or Jack's or John's or Jean's than take my chances eating out
at Smokey Joe's Cafe.
Ooh, I risk my life when that Smokey Joe's a crazy fool.
Cafe. Oh, I at Smokey Joe's Cafe. Oh, I at Smokey Joe's Cafe.
From Southern California, where there actually was Smokey Joe's Cafe, it's now been replaced by a mall that has a giant pink berry in it. I'm Harry Shearer. This is Le Show, and now... News of the Atom, our friend, Attie. Attie?
Yeah, I got my swim trunks on.
Those must be tiny.
They're medium.
Right then. Dateline Braceville, Illinois. Radioactive tritium has leaked from three-quarters of U.S. commercial nuclear power sites, often into groundwater from corroded buried piping, according to an Associated Press investigation. The number and severity of the leaks has been escalating even as federal regulators extend the licenses of more and more reactors across the nation. Tritium, ladies and gentlemen. A radioactive form of hydrogen has leaked from at least 65 sites, according to the NRC records reviewed by the AP's year-long examination of safety issues at aging nuclear power plants. Hey, good for you, AP. Leaks from at least 37 of those facilities contained concentrations exceeding the federal drinking water standard, sometimes at hundreds of times the limit. Have plenty of tritium every day. While most leaks have been found within plant boundaries, some have migrated off-site. None has known to have reached public water supplies. At three sites, two in Illinois, one in Minnesota, leaks have contaminated drinking wells of nearby homes, but not at levels violating the drinking water standard. At a fourth site in New Jersey, tritium has leaked into an aquifer. That's a marine animal that has fur. No, it's not. No, contrary to. And a discharged canal feeding picturesque Barnegat Bay. Previously, the AP reported that regulators and industry have weakened safety standards for decades to keep the nation's commercial nuclear reactors operating within the rules. If you can't operate it within the rules, change the rules. See? It's like the New Orleans pumps couldn't pass the test. Well, lower the testing standards. Still couldn't pass, but while NRC officials and plant operators argue that safety margins can be eased without peril, critics say these accommodations are inching the reactors closer to an accident. But you know, that tritium is so darn refreshing on a hot summer's day. Japanese government specialists project that the quantity of radioactive cesium emitted to date from the crippled Fukushima atomic power plant equals 168 times the amount released in the bombing of Hiroshima, according to Agence France-Presse. Citing the work of nuclear experts, the Tokyo Shimbun reported the quantity of cesium that escaped the Japanese facility was projected to be 15,000 terabecquerels. I have a couple of those for lunch every day. The Japanese administration provided the cesium projection to Japanese lawmakers. By the way, the Japanese prime minister resigned this week, saying he wasn't good enough. The government contends it's not appropriate to compare the two nuclear disasters, because that was then. Dateline King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission says no major damage has been found at the 12 nuclear power plant sites that got inspections but were not shut down following the earthquake on the East Coast. We still don't know about the hurricane. Some areas close to Japan's crippled Fuk plant will remain likely a no-go zone for several decades. The Yomiuri Shimbun Daily, citing an unnamed government source, said areas within about 3 kilometers of the plant will likely be kept off limits, possibly for several decades. Now, here's making lemonade out of lemons. Or is it making more lemons? The government may buy up some of the land from residents to use as... any guesses? That's right, temporary nuclear waste storage dumps. See? It's a system. It all works. Weakened safety programs for the Savannah River site's tritium project could increase the potential for accidents, according to a federal oversight board. It's given the Energy Department 90 days to address the concerns. The Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board say its concerns involve, quote, changes in the safety philosophy, unquote, that place too much reliance on untested procedures. They reduce the safety margin and increase the potential for both workers and the public to be exposed to higher consequences, says the board chairman. The tritium program, there's that tritium again. Tritium in pink. The program employs about 450 workers, is one of the last nuclear weapons functions still based at Savannah River site, includes periodic recharging of the tritium reservoirs in nuclear warheads. That's right, tritium is used in nuclear warheads. Drink up. It's a gas that increases explosive power, has a half-life of about 12 and a half years, and does require recharging. Hey, who doesn't these days? China has vastly increased the risk of a nuclear accident by opting for cheap technology that will be 100 years old by the time dozens of reactors reach the end of their lifespans, according to diplomatic cables from the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. This is just after Beijing resumed its ambitious nuclear expansion programs. Cables released this week by WikiLeaks, oh, there's nothing new there, highlight the secrecy of the bidding process for power plant contracts, the influence of government lobbying, and potential weaknesses in the management and regulatory oversight of China's expanding nuclear sector. All reactor purchases to date, according to the American embassy, have been largely a result of internal high-level political decisions absent any open process. A bigger concern for the U.S. embassy is that China seems more interested in building its own reactor, the CPR-1000, based on an old Westinghouse design, rather than by new reactors from, say, us. Tokyo Electric Power predicted in 2000... Oh, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, this affects more than just nukes. Tokyo Electric Power predicted in 2008 that a tsunami could reach a height of more than 15 meters, about 49 feet, at the Fukui power plant, according to government sources. The discovery of this prediction contradicts TEPCO's assertions that the size of the March 11th tsunami this year was, quote, unpredictable, unquote. So when you hear either government or company spokespeople say that something that's just happened could never have been predicted, what they mean by that is that it was predicted. Unpredictable means predictable. In its 2008 assessment, TEPCO predicted that a more than 33-foot tsunami could hit the nuclear plant. The tsunami, in fact, was about 36 feet high. But TEPCO did not incorporate its 2008 assessment in its own countermeasures against tsunami. They were in the file, though. They filed them. Federal regulators say they're stepping up oversight at First Energy Corporation's Perry Nuclear Power Plant in Ohio, where an incident in April exposed workers to increased radiation levels. An inspection by NRC found low to moderate safety concerns. The plant is located on Lake Erie. Hope you're not drinking your water out of there. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has found that Entergy's Waterford 3 power plant allowed highly radioactive coolant water to leak inside the plant during a refueling shutdown 2 years ago. The incident resulted in increased radiation exposure to workers. Maybe you don't want to have a job in one of those. The plant is located in St. Charles Parish, Louisiana. The plant, quote, failed to keep highly radioactive water from leaking onto work areas around the reactor coolant pumps, despite knowledge that this condition could occur. Who could have predicted that? This failure resulted in high levels of radioactive contamination and unexpected and unintended doses to plant workers. The spokesman for the plant said the incident did not endanger the public or the workers, whose radiation exposure is monitored in real time. The water did not escape the plant's containment building. Entergy will meet with NRC officials to determine what could have been done better. I wonder. What could we possibly do? And a senior scholar at the Institute of Policy Studies has authored a report on the dangers associated with how the majority of nuclear spent fuel is stored in the U.S. You don't want to know. Well, maybe you do. I don't. Do you, Addie?
I know. Oh, believe me, I know. You don't.
Clean, cheap, safe, too cheap, safe. Our friend Addie the Atom. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Addie, don't dive from the edge of the pool.
I won't.
Concern for his safety. The Arab Spring has delighted Al-Qaeda and caused an intelligence disaster for the United States and Britain, according to the former head of the CIA unit in charge of pursuing Osama bin Laden. Speaking in Edinburgh, Michael Scheuer said the help we were getting from the Egyptian intelligence service, less so from the Tunisians, but certainly from the Libyans, has dried up either because of resentment at our government stabbing their political leaders in the back or because those who work for the services have taken off in fear of being incarcerated or worse. The amount of work that has devolved on U.S. and British services is enormous. The result is blindness in our ability to watch what's going on among militants. Scheuer headed the bin Laden unit at the CIA from 1996 to 1999. Good work, babe. But here's, way down deep in the article, here's the interesting part. Do you remember the program called Extraordinary Rendition? It was started under the Clinton administration. The initial defense of it was to get malefactors back to their countries where they could be tried. Then it became morphed into something else. Now, here's what it is. According to Scheuer, the rendition program must come back. The people we have in custody now are pretty long in the tooth in terms of the information they can provide in interrogation. So we got to kidnap and send people to countries where they might be, you know, roughed up. Just for intelligence purposes. Nothing more. And 90 months after the Haiti earthquake, almost 600,000 Haitian people are still living in camps, mostly under tents and tarps. Despite the billions of dollars of aid pledged by governments and donors since the earthquake, there are probably less than 50,000 that have been resettled. And for the 600,000 homeless, the strategy seems to be moving in the direction of evictions without regard as to where they might end up. According to The Guardian, 20 trailers designed to serve as hurricane shelters as well as classrooms in Haiti appear to be unfit for uses either. Built by Clayton Homes in the United States and funded by the Clinton Foundation, they're neither hurricane-proof nor decent places for children to learn because of heat, unsatisfactory sanitation facilities, lack of ventilation, leaks, mold, and high levels of formaldehyde. Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, it's a fine classroom. And the Clinton Foundation pledged to respond to those findings by responding to those findings. News from outside the bubble. Ladies and gentlemen, as always, for your listening pleasure, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And speaking of Kansas City, the apologies of the week. You'll see what I mean.
We're so sorry.
Stick with me. Kansas City School District Superintendent John Covington has apologized for the confusion caused after he suddenly submitted his resignation this week following an executive session of the school board. Sources told the local newspaper, the Kansas City Star, that Covington's decision may have been spurred by ongoing tensions with the board's president over procurement contracts. I apologize, he says, for the untimely submission of my resignation this week. It was never my intent to cause confusion or alarm. And Bishop John McGee, you heard of him earlier in this broadcast, former Bishop of Cloyne, apologized for the clerical abuse that took place during his tenure. Appointed in 1987, he retired under pressure March last year amid reports of continued efforts to cover up abuse. Quote, to the victims, I say, I'm truly horrified by the abuse that they suffered, he said. It all came to me very clearly when I read the complete report. And if by my not fully implementing the 1996 guidelines, I've made any victim suffer more, on my bended knee, I beg forgiveness. I am sorry, he He also offered to meet privately with victims and ply them with liquor. No, sorry. Didn't offer to ply them with liquor. They can bring their own liquor. A Santa Ana, California city councilwoman, Santa Ana, apologized this week for comments she made at a meeting a day earlier in which she compared a downtown property owner, you guessed it, to Hitler. What I said was inappropriate, and I let my emotions get the best of me, Mayor Pro Tem Claudia Alvarez said. This is a comment she made at Wednesday's council meeting during discussion of a controversial tax for downtown property owners. Yes, Santa Ana has a downtown. Why do you ask? A portion of those taxes go to Downtown Incorporated, an organization charged with promoting downtown Santa Ana. That's why I mentioned it. Hey, so if Hitler rents you a place, he's giving us a great deal, so who cares what he stands for? We need to put a stop to this, she said. This is referred to a landlord who walked out of the meeting with his son. Both of the property owner's parents are Holocaust survivors from Poland. Said the property owner's father hid in the mountains with two Catholic families for almost 4 years. His mother made German army uniforms and spent time in Auschwitz. They lost more than 300 relatives. That was the worst thing she could have said, said the property owner, Irving Chase. Alvarez has apologized. I obviously need to learn how to keep my cool. When told of her apology, the property owner, Mr. Chase, had no comment. That's almost as much restraint as I had in referring to reading you the story about Ms. Buttrose. And the British Broadcasting Corporation has apologized for promoting a pork dish for the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr. BBC said the dish pork vindaloo was included among recipes for the holiday posted on its website by mistake. It said that the automatic suggestion system caused the mistake. That's a new one to blame. It was the automatic suggestion system's fault. The holiday is the 3-day event celebrating the end of Ramadan. Well, how could the BBC know about that? The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And just one more item. For years, California flood officials have pleaded with the Army Corps of Engineers to reconsider a policy that bans trees on levees. Now, a new study by the Army Corps has found that trees actually strengthen levees in some situations. The conclusion could force the agency to reconsider its policy, which would otherwise eliminate millions of trees in California's Central Valley. What are you on about? Building strong and taking care of people. That's their motto. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide, throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet. Yes, you've heard of it. At two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com. Available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like a tall, brimming glass full of tritium if you'd agree to join with me, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. If you're in Southern California, I'll be signing DVDs of The Big Uneasy tomorrow night at a shank of the evening, 6:30-ish, at Amoeba in Hollywood. If you're not in Southern California, I won't be doing that. And I'll be on Kevin Pollak's internet video chat show later this afternoon. Unless it's evening where you are. A typical show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. This broadcast is on Twitter at The Harry Shearer. Join the more than 43,000 followers. I need followers to lead. The Big Uneasy, now available in digital platforms. What does that mean? TheBigNEasy.com has all the details. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. We'll be right back.